Now, let's get right to our guest this morning. The summer camp for burn injured youth begins August 7th in East Troy, and registration remains open. As always, you can find the link to more information on the summer camp for burn injured youth at our website, WPR.org/mornings. And you are welcome to join our conversation at any time with questions, your shared stories and experiences, 1-800-642-1234. The People Power of Healing. You can also email us ideas at WPR.org. Our guest this morning with your invitation for the children, Tanya Bolchin, joins us, camp counselor at summer camp for burn injured youth. She's been with the camp for 28 years. Tanya, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. Also, Melissa Kirsten. She's an advanced nurse practitioner at Ascension Columbia St. Mary's Regional Burn Center in Milwaukee. She's volunteered at the summer camp for burn injured youth in East Troy since 2004 and has been its director since 2016. Melissa, welcome to you.
Good morning, Lee. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. And let's begin this morning with an invitation. The camp is in its 28th year. The camp starts in 10 days, and it's a free week-long summer camp for kids. For younger children, there are day sessions as well. Kids with burn injuries. Registration open now and again. The link can be found at WPR.org/mornings. Melissa Kirsten, how is the program tailored to children with burn injuries?
So the tailoring of it is, you know, we want to make sure that these children understand that they are not alone in the journey that they are now on. So they understand coming into camp that there are going to be other children that have similar injuries like themselves. So they can kind of have that peer support that a lot of people seek, because it's really difficult to feel like you're the only one that's gone through something. So knowing that you're not alone is pretty exciting and pretty cool to see.
Especially as a child.
Agreed. Yes.
And Tanya, you're a camp attendee turned counselor. You were an attendee for 9 years, but you've been a counselor for 19. And yet, tell me a little bit about that first year and what you were thinking about before you'd ever gone to this summer camp before. Were you a little hesitant to join in?
Yeah, that first year, I just wasn't sure about it. I didn't know anyone except for like my nurse who was telling me about the whole camp. So just the idea of being away from my family for a week was a little scary, whole new people, but I'm so glad I went.
What do you hear when Melissa Kirsten says this is a camp tailored to children so that they know that they are not alone? Once you finally went to camp, what was that experience like, and how is it that you've been going back now for 28 years, well into your adulthood?
It was amazing. It was the first time that I had been around other people who, like me, had been burned, and just the relief of knowing you're not alone. And then they understand the stress that comes with that, like the burns and the surgeries and missing school and having to make up your assignments afterwards. And just, you keep going. I kept going back every year because of that support and the family that you build there. And just the wanting to see those people year after year, so like you grow with them and hear what's going on in their lives. So just making sure that we get to see each other is always amazing.
Melissa Kirsten, director of the Summer Camp for Burn Injured Youth. From Tanya, you just heard it. She reluctant at first because she would leave her family and her support structure, and then she goes to the Summer Camp for Burn Injured Youth and finds another family and another support structure that has kept her coming back for almost 30 years. Tell me, as an advanced nurse practitioner at Ascension Columbia St. Mary's Regional Burn Center in Milwaukee, what's this experience of summer camp like for you, Melissa?
So I think that, you know, as you can imagine, working in a burn center, you see a lot of very tragic accidents and injuries. And to be able to go to a summer camp with people like Tanya, who have found the connections that they were seeking and didn't maybe even know that they needed, and to have that support system and to watch them thrive after something so tragic and awful happening is, it helps me become a better provider, because I can kind of go back to work and say, this can get better. There are people out there that have gone through something like this, and you can also get back to your life, and let me maybe help introduce you to people that can help you, show you the way, because they can say, I've been there. I know what you've been through, which is something that I, never having been burned, can't say. Right. I can't identify with that as closely.
We're talking about Burn Camp that starts August 7th in East Troy. The camp is in its 28th year now. It is free, week-long summer camp for kids. There are day camps for younger children. And it's put on by the Professional Firefighters of Wisconsin. Our guest, Tanya Bolchin, who is the attendee turned camp counselor. Melissa Kirsten, who is the camp director. She was first a volunteer and an advanced nurse practitioner at Ascension Columbia St. Mary's Regional Burn Center in Milwaukee. And Melissa, part of the reason we're here this morning is there is at least some concern that there are children that could benefit from this camp that do not know about this camp yet. What are some of the barriers that exist for people to attend?
So I think just not knowing about it obviously is one. If you don't know, you can't go, right?
Right.
And the other barrier would be that, you know, sometimes there's hesitancy, like Tanya talks about. She was scared. She didn't know what it was about. So that's one of the reasons we started offering our day program, where the potential campers and their parents or their guardians can come with them to kind of explore, get to know us, and kind of familiarize themselves with it. Another barrier is maybe, you know, you feel like you're too advanced, your wounds aren't fully healed, and that can be a barrier, but you know, if we can still connect with you and maybe next year you can attend, sometimes that can be obviously a barrier. It's too soon after your injury, you know, can't be in the sun or, you know, away from medical treatments.
Tanya Bolchin, I'm curious, as a counselor, how you help campers feel comfortable. What is your role as the Summer Camp for Burn Injured Youth gets underway?
So I am the activities coordinator this year. So like just trying to make sure there's fun things to do and just letting kids take it at their own pace, having different types of activities and just letting them figure out where they're at. Well, you can do a quiet activity. You can do a loud activity. There's just things to do. And just if they want to talk, I'm there to talk. If they just want to like sit and fish for a bit, we can go do that too. So just making sure that they're comfortable where they're at, and then when they're ready to talk about something, they'll let you know. And so just making sure we're present for that.
This family, this support structure, the second family, second support structure that you found, Tanya, what's it like being a part of that support structure for children today as an adult? How, at the end of the week of camp, what do you walk away feeling?
I feel energized because, you know, there's a lot going on right now. So like just going back and hanging out with that second family for a week and just focusing on that, it's just narrowing it down, refocusing, and just I go back into the world, back to work, just feeling more relaxed, ready to see what happens next.
And take me back a little bit to your 9 years before you were a counselor at the Summer Camp for Burn Injured Youth, when you were actually an attendee at the summer camp. And did it make the rest of the year easier? Did you get tools in your toolbox to deal with the rest of the world with everything happening? When you were a kid, Tanya, what was it like at the end of the week of this summer camp for you? What did you walk away with then?
Yeah, it gave me tools in my toolbox. So how to talk about my injuries and when I was ready to talk about them. So camp happens right before school. So you're getting this extra boost before going back in the classroom and just being ready to be like, yes, I'm ready to tell my story. And then if maybe, you know, it's one of those days where I'm not ready to talk about it, just knowing the language, be like, I understand your question, but I'm not going to talk about that today. And having that be fine as a final answer to people and just getting that confidence to be able to say that.
And taking the agency of your burn injuries. And you know, it's part of who you are. And there is a community there to remind us that that doesn't mean anything other than you are a part of a community with a second family and a second support structure, an entire summer camp coming up here in just 10 days. So, Tanya, I very much appreciate your time this morning. And I want to wrap up with this, and that is a call to the kids who have severe burn injuries and what advice you would have for them.
So your burn injury is part of you, who you are. It's part of your story, and it's a big part of your story, but it doesn't have to be the only part of your story. There's so much more to go. There's so much more to do, and just make sure you get that support that you need so you can go and live your life and live the rest of your story.
Because you're not alone.
Exactly.
You're never alone. Tanya Bolchin, I hope you have a wonderful time at summer camp this year, and I hope you come back to tell us all about it.
Thank you for having me this morning.
You bet. Tanya Bolchin's attendee of the summer camp for burn injured youth for years before becoming a camp counselor herself. We will be back in a minute with Melissa Kirsten to continue our conversation on burn injuries, which impact almost 500,000 people a year. She's an advanced nurse practitioner at Ascension Columbia St. Mary's Regional Burn Center in Milwaukee. She's the director of the summer camp for burn injured youth coming up in just 10 days with registration still open. It is free and available to children who qualify. You can check it out ages 3 to 21. Online at WPR.org/mornings. You can also join us this morning with your questions, your shared experiences and stories at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and the summer camp for burn injured youth is just less than 2 weeks away in East Troy. It's open to kids with burn injuries from the ages of 3 to 21, and it is free. More information available on our website at WPR.org/mornings. Our guest is Melissa Kirsten, advanced nurse practitioner at Ascension Columbia St. Mary's Regional Burn Center, Milwaukee, known for developing the outpatient burn clinic there and lead support groups with burn survivors. We join her for the next 10 minutes, and you can join us as well at 1-800-642-1234. And again, I want to thank Tanya for joining us earlier, but Melissa, just from the numbers, the statistics now, how common are burn injuries for children in Wisconsin? Do we have numbers on that?
That is a great question, Lee. I honestly do not have those numbers in front of me. I was unprepared for that. I apologize,
but I do know
that it's common. It is very common. We see in our, I know between Children's Hospital in Milwaukee, us at Ascension Columbia St. Mary's, and in Madison, we see a good portion of our patient population, obviously at Children's, is all kids that have in their burn center burn injuries, but it's a fairly common accident that can happen to children throughout the year.
Mm. And you're also now, formerly as a volunteer, now a director of the summer camp, the director of the summer camp for burn injured youth. And Melissa, some campers have burns due to abuse, like scalding water as punishment. And how do camp counselors, how do people like Tanya and your team begin to even cope with being a burn survivor who was abused as a child?
So I think that is one of the, you know, it's the difficult thing to obviously go through and to know that you're having a camper come in that has been injured by abuse. You focus on just making the camp week fun for them. We do a lot of training with our staff prior to coming to camp and how to talk to the children and making sure that we have child life specialists there in case there's something there's really hard to that. They have they're working through so that there's somebody that's more on the expert level that can talk to that child. So I think that it's a holistic approach as well, making sure that they have the space and the comfort level they need if they do want to talk about something.
Yeah, with your counselor, Tanya, talking about two support structures with this summer camp for burn injured youth, it may provide just one support structure, and that may be make all the difference. In a bigger picture, Melissa, you run the support group for burn survivors at Ascension Columbia St. Mary's Regional Burn Center, where that group talks about burn scars. And what would your advice be to those who are concerned about the visibility of their burn scars? What stories do you share? What advice do you give?
So I think Tanya spoke very well about that earlier is, you know, we try to teach the knowing how to tell your story. It's practicing any story that we have in our life. It's practicing and talking about that to make sure that you know, and who deserves that full story? Not everybody, the person you meet in the grocery store that has the audacity perhaps to ask you what happened to your skin, your face, wherever your burn is, do they deserve your full story, every nitty gritty detail? Or do they maybe, I was burned in a fire. I'm doing great right now. I really like your purse. Where did you get it? And kind of redirecting that question perhaps is more appropriate than answering that question. So being able to feel prepared for answering those questions, it can be very empowering for many people, no matter what your story is.
Absolutely. I've practiced this story many times before we got together this morning, Melissa.
Exactly.
I also, with the shift from being a longtime volunteer at the summer camp for burn injured youth to taking over the mantle and becoming the director of this summer camp, what was that change like for you? And did it change your perspective on what this camp provides?
It absolutely changed my perspective on the behind the scenes, what happens with preparing camp and the amount of work that is put into it and the effort and the love and support that we're, you know, infusing into the camp. But the change was kind of hard for me because it takes me a little bit away from that interaction, one-on-one interaction with the campers that I used to have. And that's the reason I started the camp, was to be able to spend time with those kids and get to know them more one-on-one. And I still have time with them, but obviously there's more behind the scenes that has to be taken care of to keep the camp running. So, I mean, somebody has to do it and it's an important role, but it is, being a camp counselor is one of the best experiences I had in my life. So, it's fun. Both jobs are great, but volunteer jobs are great, but it's, camp counseling was really pivotal in my life.
Yeah. What do you get? What do you get from these kids, Melissa? What do they teach you?
Resiliency, I think, would be one of the big words that I would use, is the resiliency of children and the resiliency of the human spirit. And just the courage to continue on no matter what has happened to you in your life, and to have the courage to go forward and to live their best life and live their story is so inspiring to me. And I'm just in awe of this community of burn survivors that I've gotten to know and made, you know, use my career to kind of work with. And it's very humbling for me to be able to kind of have a glimpse into that world. I think I would encourage anybody to come and join us and volunteer, because it's a really rewarding experience.
And what does it mean in terms of your work as you return back to the Burn Center at Ascension Columbia St. Mary's?
I think it keeps me from making sure that, you know, when we see those sad cases, maybe there's death, to know that it's not just that. It's so much more. There's so much more. The people that leave that hospital can, you know, make that a part of the story, like Tanya said, and not their full story. And helping encourage them to do that, you know, encouraging them to, you know, seek the mental health therapy, perhaps, that maybe they need, to kind of give them the tools in their toolbox, as you mentioned earlier, to go out in life and, you know, conquer the world like they had always planned to do.
As we're running short on time here, we could talk about any other aspects of this. We really haven't mentioned the physical aspects of burn injuries, emotional and psychological and social and all that. But the thing that, with the time we have left, I want to talk about prevention. We could prevent a lot of these burn injuries for kids. It's just a matter of, I would imagine, being aware and being preventative. How do we go about it?
Absolutely. I think, you know, some of the quick things I would mention is, if you're moving into a new apartment or you have a house, you know, if your water heater, checking the temperature of your water heater, making sure that it's not too hot, so you're not, you know, accidentally causing scald burns as, you know, you're giving your child a bath or a shower, turning the handle on the pot in the kitchen, on the stove, so that, you know, little hands don't reach up and grab things, you know, helping children when they're putting things into the microwave. One of the biggest things we see is scald burns down on to the chest when, you know, children may be pulling something out of a microwave and it falls down on top of them, you know, mac and cheese or Easy Mac, you know, that's a very common injury. You know, safety outside, making sure that, you know, you keep little people away from your grill because they're tripping falls in the wintertime, making sure your fireplace, if you have a fireplace, you keep, some kind of barrier around it so that, you know, trip and falls, your young children aren't falling and reaching out and touching the glass fireplaces. You know, I think cooking safety, like I mentioned, is a huge one, though. Being very careful in the kitchen, making sure children aren't around, running around while you're carrying maybe that pot of noodles from the stove to the sink to dump it out. Just being very cautious with those types of things, I think, are really important.
Melissa, have a blast at summer camp, and come back, please, and keep inviting us back again every summer. Very much appreciate your time this morning.
Well, Thank you so much, Lee, for having both Tanya and I. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Melissa Kirsten is an advanced nurse practitioner in Ascension Columbia St. Mary's Regional Burn Center in Milwaukee. She's also the director of the Summer Camp for Burn Injured Youth, which starts August 7th, and you can find details online at wpr.org/mornings. Registration still open, and it is free to children ages 3 to 21, with day camps available as well. Earlier, we spoke with Tanya Bolchin, who's a burn survivor and camp counselor at Summer Camp for Burn Injured Youth, where she was an attendee originally. The camp again August 7th. Ahead this hour, we explore African-American history in the Midwest with a UW historian, from the Great Migration to the fight for voting rights. That's after your news. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on a Thursday morning. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent. And when Wisconsin voters adopted our state constitution way back in 1848, they endorsed these words, quoting, "All men are born equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights," end quote. But despite that declaration, everyone in the state couldn't vote. Those rights were reserved for white men over age 21, with some exceptions. It took nearly 20 years and a Supreme Court case before black men could vote in Wisconsin, and then it took several more decades before women could vote. How did this come to be? What forces shaped the building of our state, and how much do you remember from your fourth grade trip to the state capitol? We're exploring Wisconsin history this morning by revisiting a conversation from the morning show's archives. Here's WPR host Molly Stentz talking with Christy Clark Pujara, an associate professor of history in the African-American Studies Department at UW-Madison.
Well, I want to start with the Constitution and 1848. Now, the Constitution that voters adopted then wasn't the first draft, and in fact was pretty radically different than an earlier draft that was proposed. Can you start us there with what that looked like, that process of forming our Constitution?
Absolutely. So Wisconsin was supposed to become a state in 1846. You could apply for statehood if your territory had amassed some 60,000 people. That was like the threshold. And after the lead rush in the Wisconsin territory, there was enough people to apply for statehood. And so Wisconsin was up for statehood in 1846, convened a state constitution, and a couple of things really tanked that first constitution. One of them was a referendum that was attached to the 1846 constitution that required an immediate vote on black male suffrage. That was deemed too radical. And when we get to the 1848 Constitution, black men are explicitly banned from participating in the electorate.
Now, what changed in those 2 years?
I don't think much changed. I think that the referendum was always going to be a long shot. And I think it was always going to be a long shot because, like white Americans throughout the nation, white Wisconsinites understood citizenship and whiteness to be one and the same. They understood black people to be outside of the nation and not a part of the nation. And that's just not my opinion. It's in the history before the state constitution convention convenes. In the Wisconsin territory, we have prominent citizens who are holding people in bondage for several years, holding black people as slaves in bondage in the region where slavery is not supposed to exist. And so it's not really surprising that the white population in Wisconsin sees black people as lesser than and not part of the electorate.
So what kind of rights did African Americans have at the time?
They didn't. They were not recognized as citizens of the United States. We tend to think about the experiences of black people in this period. And so let's say, you know, from the Revolutionary War through the American Civil War, really simplistically, like they were either enslaved in the American South or they were free in the North. And that technically was true. Although slavery falls apart in the North really slowly and haphazardly. And just to give you an example of that, the state of Rhode Island didn't abolish slavery until 1848. The state of New York didn't until 1827. New Jersey never does. But the bulk of Black people in the northern states and in some Midwestern territories are free, but they are people who do not lack who do not have access to liberty. They're not voting. They don't sit on juries. They are banned from the militia. They attend segregated schools. They attend segregated churches. It's a Jim Crow society. We tend to associate that term with the South, and it came into being in post-Civil War America. But the northern states and territories functioned in the way that the Jim Crow South is going to function 150 years later. So Black people are free, but they do not have liberty. And in places like Wisconsin during the territorial period, they weren't even free, despite the ban on slavery in the Northwest Territory. Slavery was functioning as an institution because no one was enforcing it, and it was accepted among the white population there.
Right. So you have territorial ordinances banning it. You have the Constitution coming into effect, also saying that slavery is not legal in Wisconsin. Yet, how much longer did it persist in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to take a longer view of this. There's a long history of race-based slaveholding before Wisconsin is ever Wisconsin, right? And so you have people of African descent that are held in bondage in what becomes Wisconsin during the French territorial period in the 1720s, right? And then you get a larger number of enslaved people in the region when people like John Rowntree and Henry Dodge and George Jones bring enslaved people into the area. These are some of the founding fathers of the Wisconsin territory. And some of them are from places like Missouri, where they were holding people in lifelong, perpetual, race-based bondage. They bring those people with them to the territories where the ban on slaveholding is not enforced. Historians, I'd say, for the past, 10, 15 years, have really been doing a deep dive into the practice of slaveholding in the Midwest. And what we found is that the ban on slavery in the Northwest Territories wasn't worth the paper it was written on. You have people being held in bondage at military forts, and those people were actually being supported by the federal government, meaning if you were a military officer who was stationed somewhere like Fort Crawford, you would be paid an allowance to have either a servant or a slave serve you and your family. So it was the practice. Now, are we talking about lots of people holding lots of people in bondage? No. I'm talking about hundreds of people, sometimes thousands of people being held in bondage. But what is clear is that it wasn't shocking, it wasn't scandalous, and it wasn't contested until statehood became evident. And once statehood becomes evident, you see the manumission of people who were never supposed to be held in bondage. And it's a weird thing to sit in an archive in a place like UW-Plattsville and read manumission papers, right, these freedom papers of people who were never supposed to be held in bondage in this region, to read suits of Black people who sue for their freedom because they know they're not supposed to be held in bondage in this place. So it's really interesting, but it's also really telling about, there's the law and then there's the practice.
Right. It reminds me why we have the Juneteenth holiday and how long it took for the country to wrestle with this question. Now, you mentioned Henry Dodge, and I'm curious to know what we know about his practices. The territorial governor, who you mentioned, was a slave owner.
Well, most people in Wisconsin, I have kids that are in elementary school now, they're going to learn about Henry Dodge or see, a park, something, a pavilion named after him. But what we don't hear is about Toby, Tom, Lear, Jim, and Joe, who he brought and held illegally in bondage for 11 years in these territories, right, who were enslaved here from 1827 until 1842. And they built his fortune. Right? There are reports that, you know, these enslaved people were bringing up 2,000 pounds of lead a day. He was making tens of thousands of dollars off their labor, and they did not benefit. Mm. When they're emancipated, they have to pay. He pays a bond on them, which again is confounding because this institution is not supposed to exist in the territories. But these are incredibly liberty-loving, resilient people who some of them go ahead and establish Pleasant Ridge, which becomes this free Black homestead outside of Lancaster, Wisconsin, where Black families find a place to be free, right? And Black people can test their bondage. You have someone like Paul Jones, who sues George W. Jones for his freedom, and he sues him for an exact amount of wages, meaning this is someone who was keeping track of what he thought he was owed, and he knew he wasn't supposed to be held in bondage as a free person in the territory. He loses his case and is emancipated a few years later, but that kind of action tells us about the active endeavor it is to hold somebody in bondage, especially people who know they're not supposed to be held in bondage and who are contesting that illegal practice.
That's UW-Madison history professor Christy Clark-Pujara talking with WPR host Molly Stentz. And we'll pick up this conversation about Wisconsin history in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Exploring Wisconsin history on the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and do you know the name Ezekiel Gillespie? It was his actions, his desire to vote in Wisconsin back in 1865 that led to a lawsuit granting voting rights to Black men. It paved the way for a more inclusive state, one brick at a time. So let's pick up learning about Wisconsin history from UW-Madison professor Christy Clark-Pujara, who's talking with my colleague, Molly Stentz.
Christy, what do we know about Ezekiel Gillespie?
We know quite a bit about Ezekiel Gillespie. We know that he was most likely born in bondage. We know that he bought his freedom from his enslaver, who was also most likely his father. We know that he migrated to the Midwest in search of freedom, like free Black people throughout the nation. There were some 60,000 free Black people that migrate into what we now call the Midwest, and they are free and they are looking for a place to live with liberty. And he first is in Indiana, and he ends up coming to Wisconsin, like many free Black folks from places like Indiana, after the fugitive slave law is passed. And Black people become even more apprehensive and less secure in their freedom. They're trying to get closer and closer to Canada if they need to make a run for it to protect themselves and their families. He was a family man. He had a total of 11 children. Two were adopted. He lost two wives, so he was widowed twice. He was left to raise young children on his own, which he did with great dedication. He was an entrepreneur. He sold groceries and foodstuffs in downtown Milwaukee and advertised his foodstuffs for sale in the paper that was edited by Sherman Booth, who was also a white abolitionist lawyer. He works as a porter for the railway company, becomes a very valued employee. And while he's doing all of that, he's also civically involved. Black people in Wisconsin, free Black people in Wisconsin, because when the state is founded in 1848, it is founded as a free state, and there are no more enslaved people of African descent. But this free population is very aware of their marginalization, and they begin to organize early on to strategize about how they get access to the ballot box. There are, you know, several referendums that, you know, fail. And Ezekiel Gillespie, along with other Black men, do things like show up to their voting places, right? These tax-paying men, and ask for the right to vote. And
yeah, what happened? What happened when he did try to vote? And that was 1865.
Yeah, that wasn't the first time he tried to vote. That was the first time he tried to vote and took Sherman Booth with him so he could witness him being turned away so he could then file suit. Right. So they're turned away. They're turned away. They're saying, you're Black. You can't vote. You don't have the right to vote in this state. And it's, you can just imagine how infuriating that must be, because Black people by this point in American history, many are 10 generations deep. The vast majority of Black Americans today trace their ancestry back to the colonial period. Right. And so Ezekiel Gillespie is being denied the right to vote as a many generations deep American. And he's standing next to white immigrants who have been in the country maybe just a few years, because you didn't even need to be a citizen to vote in the state of Wisconsin. You just needed to be a white man over 21 who had lived here a year. And if you weren't a citizen and a white man, you just had to declare an intention. Right. That's how conflated whiteness and citizenship were in early Wisconsin. And you can imagine someone like Ezekiel Gillespie, that's many generations deep, right, being denied the right to vote in a place where he pays taxes in a state that declares itself free, right? And so he sues for his freedom. It works its way through the courts rather quickly, which is an indication that the court was looking to take up a case like this. And the Supreme Court rules in his favor. And they rule in his favor not because there's a shift in thinking about Black men and their access to the ballot box, whether they're worthy or not, whether they should have the right or not. The court rules on a technicality. In 1849, so just after, a year after the 1848 Constitution is ratified and put in place, the Republican Party gets a referendum on Black male suffrage on the ballot. But the vast majority of white men, and it's only white men voting, right, don't vote on the measure. Let me look at my numbers. So 5,200 approve, 4,075 say no, but about 32,000 don't vote on it at all. And the State Board of Canvassers takes those abstention votes and counts them as no votes and says Black men can't vote. And the 1866 Supreme Court case says that what the Board of Canvassers did in 1849 was wrong, that they should have never considered the abstentions as no votes,
so,
and only counted the votes cast.
So everyone who did not vote in that election was automatically considered a no vote to be against suffrage.
Right. And the thing is, there are two more referendums after that. And in those referendums, the vast majority of white men vote on them and they vote no, about 60%.
So this,
the Supreme Court rules what happened in 1849 was wrong. And so those other referendums don't even count, including the one that happened in 1865, which also was a no by 60%. Right. That none of those count because what happened in 1849 was technically wrong.
But it took almost two decades for the courts to hear that challenge.
Yes.
And
Black people are organizing. They're meeting at churches. They're talking about this. They're attending political conventions in places like Chicago, because this is an issue for free Black people throughout the North and the Midwest. How do we get the rights of citizenship?
We're speaking with Christy Clark-Bujara, history professor of African American Studies Department at UW-Madison, taking your calls 1-800-642-1234. So, Christy, this Supreme Court case in Wisconsin's history after these decades establishes black male suffrage, but it takes us several more decades to achieve women's suffrage. What happened over that period of time?
So women's suffrage in Wisconsin is like women's suffrage throughout most of the rest of the country. So women are organizing here. I have come across no evidence of any kind of interracial cooperation. What I have come across are white women using black men's access to the ballot box to argue for themselves. They say things like, even black men are allowed to vote and we're not, how horrible. Mm-hmm. And so they actually make a racist argument about how they should be allowed to vote because black men can vote in the state.
Wow.
Women don't gain the right to vote in Wisconsin until the 19th Amendment is passed, but there is no, cooperation between black and white women and that was pretty true throughout the country. Most white suffragettes separated themselves from black women who too, through the National Association of Colored Women, are also fighting for the right to vote. And they were very prominent black suffragists, but we rarely get to know them or talk about them. And so it's important to remember that voting has always been contested in this space. And I think that speaks to contemporary moments. When we think about who has access to the ballot box now, why we have voter ID laws, what those are intended to do. Voting has always been something that has been raced, right? It's been sexed, and it's been contested.
That was UW-Madison history professor Christy Clark-Pujara talking with WPR host Molly Stentz. Now, to hear more conversations from the morning show's archives anytime, you can visit our webpage at wpr.org/mornings. You can download the WPR app. Got a program suggestion for the morning show? You can also find our contact info on our website, and that's wpr.org/mornings. Where a reminder, you'll also find a link from our first guest this morning about the summer camp for youth with burn injuries. Now, just ahead, next hour, the director for the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison warns in her new book, A World Without Soil, that global soil erosion is an invisible crisis. Dire, in her words. And we speak with a biologist and author about the harms of worldwide soil erosion after the news. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.